Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to release its final opinions of the term. Heavily watched cases still to be decided include the citizenship question and whether it should be on the 2020 census, also two gerrymandering cases involving political parties drawing geographic voting districts to their own partisan advantage. Today in The Exchange, as we wait for these rulings, we provide you with a refresher on what they're all about, and we'll cover several other significant high court decisions of the term, from the role of race in jury selection to a consumer challenge against tech giant Apple. Let's hear from you. What Supreme Court cases have caught your attention? What questions or comments do you have about them? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, John Grabe, director of UNH Law's Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service, and a law professor at UNH Law. And John, really nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Jennifer Sargent, visiting associate professor at Dartmouth College, also a former public defender and a district judge. And Jen, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Thanks. Nice to see you.
Well, both of you, let's tackle this census case first. This has received tons of coverage. We did a whole show on The Exchange on this a couple of weeks ago. As many listeners know, the Trump administration wants to include a citizenship question on the upcoming census. This hasn't been done in 40 or 50 years. Jen, to you first, please. Who brought the case against this effort?
Well, several attorneys general of some states brought the case, and they wanted to stop the census, the question of U.S. citizenship from being placed on the census. The Supreme Court took it up, skipping the normal route through the intermediate appellate courts. And so now the Supreme Court has before it the question of whether or not the question, are you a U.S. citizen, should be on the census. And the census deadline for drawing up the questions for the new 2020 census is coming right up. I mean, it's mere week and a half or so away. So
oh, wow.
This is a pressing question.
So why did the attorneys general of these states say that this is a bad idea? What were their arguments?
Well, their arguments were that it was going to suppress voter participation, and it was discriminatory against certain types of groups, especially large groups of Hispanics, and that it didn't serve the government's purpose of reinforcing any kind of concern under the Voting Rights Act.
Interesting. John, I'd love your take on this case and how it's moved very quickly.
It has moved quickly, yeah. I mean, it's yet another example of a phenomenon we've seen, for example, last year in the travel ban case, where the question is whether or not courts should take at face value what the government says that it is doing and why it says it is doing it. You know, as Jen just suggested, the reason supposedly for adding this question to the census is to gain information that would help the government in enforcing the Voting Rights Act. Cynics would say that the Trump administration has shown very little interest in other contexts in actually enforcing the Voting Rights Act. Moreover, its own study showed that, you know, millions of people would decline to answer the census generally if this question is added. Many of those people would be Hispanic. And of course, the census determines representation in Congress. It determines the amount of federal funding that goes to certain jurisdictions. And cynics would say that this is really all about empowering diminishing the power of urban areas and areas where there are large Hispanic populations.
So I'm guessing the two of you were not in the Supreme Courtroom when this case was argued, but what did you glean, John, from what the justices asked, how the lawyers responded? What was the sort of tone and tenor of the hearing on this?
Well, following it through the news, as I understand it, the thought was that this would be a 5-4 decision, with the conservative justices allowing the question to be added and unwilling to sort of poke beneath the surface and second-guess the reasons given for the addition of the question, again, much like the travel ban last year. What is really going to put some pressure on that outcome if that happens is that since the case was argued, an additional trove of evidence was identified on the computer of a Republican operative, suggesting that, strongly showing that there was indeed a partisan purpose here of increasing white and Republican power at the expense of Hispanic power.
Yeah, and that came out as this was making its way through the system. Yeah. As you said, former Republican operative, deceased, and redistricting expert Thomas Hoffeller wrote that including the citizenship question would lead to a decrease, as you said, John, in the political power of Latinos. The Department of Justice has said these accusations are baseless. This gentleman reportedly urged inclusion of this question in the census. This came out as it was making its way through. Jen, does that have an impact, though? I mean, justices like to say, you know, we're above the daily news cycle, we're above politics.
Well, a lot of people think that this is not going to have an impact in the sense that if the court, and especially Chief Justice Roberts, wants to legitimize the court, that they're going to try to make a decision and they're going to try to make a decision that isn't a 5-4 decision. However, as John pointed out, during the oral arguments, and oral arguments aren't always telling about which way the justices are going to go, but during the oral arguments, it was reported that the justices really did separate along party lines, the conservative bloc very much in favor of seeing this question on the census and the liberal bloc very much not in favor of seeing it. So Judge Hazel, who is the judge in the Maryland District Court, is the judge who's sort of behind whether or not this evidence of the political operative is going to be of a particular import. You know, the court has an option, I suppose. It could hold off on deciding this. It doesn't have to render a decision today. I think that's unlikely. I think we will get a decision. But it sort of harkens back to what we were thinking about when we had our show where we talked about the Trump travel ban, which was how much of the intent of the executive branch and especially of the president. Like when the president, it's insinuated that the president might be intending to use a political tool or a legal tool to mold the process that might put him or her in power or help a party get into power, whether or not there's some import to that. And now that there's some pretty definitive evidence, at least suggesting that it wasn't a Voting Rights Act question, that it was really a play to make sure that Republicans got their voting districts.
So you seem to be saying they are somewhat affected by the news of these documents, by this operative who says, yeah, let's do this because it'll help us in the election.
The pressure, as John said, is on.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about this, but I also want to remind our listeners, these cases are going to be probably ruled on later today. In fact, maybe shortly after we get off the air. So still to be decided, the citizenship question and gerrymandering. That's another big, big issue before the court that we've talked a lot about on this show. You can join us with your questions or comments about the legal aspects of these issues. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Now, John, not to get too sort of insidery, court watchery, but I have read a lot recently that Chief Justice Roberts does not want the court to be seen as political. This kind of follows up on what Jen was saying. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that is a theme he has sounded since his nomination to the chief justiceship, that, you know, he is an institutionalist. He recognizes perhaps more or cares more than anyone else in the conservative bloc about the fact that the court's legitimacy flows from it being accepted as a law court and not merely another tool of partisan politics. And for that to happen, the court needs to behave like a law court. And so he is the one, I think, with Justice Kennedy having retired last year and having been replaced by Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who many expect to be more conservative than Justice Kennedy was, he now moves into that central role. And, you know, he will be the deciding vote, for example, on questions of whether the Supreme Court should revisit old precedent, whether they should follow this doctrine known as stare decisis to stand by old decisions, whether they agree or disagree with those decisions, or whether they should, you know, engage in a revamping of constitutional law. The downside of such a revamping is that in the eyes of the public, the court can look like merely another tool of partisan politics.
And John Roberts really cares about that.
I think so. I think he does. Yeah, he's been a consistently reliable conservative vote. But many people would point to his vote in the Obamacare decision, the Affordable Care Act decision from several years ago, where he was the crucial vote to uphold the heart of the bill. Many people infer from that there was a concern about the reputation of the court behind that decision.
A couple more questions on this, and then I do want to move on to gerrymandering. Also, there are some really interesting cases concerning a war memorial, religious expression, free speech, and a long, long, long-standing case concerning whether juries need to take more care to have equal racial participation in those juries, a case out of Mississippi that many listeners will be familiar with. But two more questions on the census. So, Jen, what happens if the court says the citizenship question is okay? Census Bureau, go ahead and put it on. What's the reaction going to be?
Well, the reaction from the public, it's going to fall on party lines. My expectation is that people who ally themselves with the Republicans or the conservatives will think that it's overall perhaps an appropriate exercise of power and discretion. And those who don't believe that it's at all that question helps the Voter Rights Act, that helps the integrity of the Voter Rights Act, they're going to think that it shouldn't be on there. I mean, the question can always come off. Let's say in, 10 years, we have a new census question being drawn up, and somebody else is in power in the executive branch. We've got a new president. Maybe that president will be able to, and the Commerce Secretary will decide that no longer that question should exist, and it will come off. But it'll be on if the court says it can be on.
Let's move on to gerrymandering. And John, to you first, clarify for us, please, where do these gerrymandering cases come from that are still undecided by the court?
Sure. There's two cases right now before the court. One comes from the state of Maryland and the other comes from the state of North Carolina. Both involve the question whether courts should be involved in overseeing partisan gerrymandering. And this is actually tied back to the census question. So every 10 years we have a census, and after that census, some states pick up some seats if their population increases. Other states can lose a seat or two in Congress. Plus, that census is then used also to redistrict within the states themselves. And it is up to state legislatures to redraw district boundaries, and it's always been understood that that happens after the census every 10 years or so. Partisan gerrymandering has become more and more powerful. We've always had it, but with computer programs and big data, the ability to draw district lines in a way to favor incumbent interests and at the expense of the party that's not in power, it's just become a much more powerful tool, and we've seen it becoming pervasive, especially given these highly partisan and divided times. The case from Maryland involves the redrawing of a congressional district by Democrats to oust an incumbent Republican. The North Carolina case involves the redrawing of district lines in North Carolina to favor the Republicans.
So this is not just congressional districts, though, right, John? This is state legislative districts and so on. you know, given the political parameters of the state in question.
That's right. Under the Constitution, state legislatures are empowered to draw federal district lines for purposes of representation in the House of Representatives. And, of course, they're empowered to draw district lines for purposes of representation in the state legislature as well.
Jen, how reluctant or eager do you think the justices are in getting involved in this, given that it does involve another branch of government, the legislative branch?
Well, if the justices weren't interested in getting involved, I don't think they'd have taken the case. They have a lot of discretion as to which cases they can take and which cases they can't. And they put this one on a fast track. So I think the justices are eager to decide the case. I think that the addition of this evidence now of the Republican operative may complicate things. But
from the census question we talked about before.
Yeah. The census question, exactly. And they don't want, let me put it this way. If there's a 5-4 split on both the census question and the gerrymandering question, I think that Chief Justice Roberts might run into a serious legitimacy problem.
Because it just looks like more of same.
More partisan split. Really bad partisan politics. So I think that they're interested in deciding the case, but maybe they're a little worried about the optics.
What do you think about that, John?
I think absolutely. I think these two cases are sort of joined at the hips, and the impression of this court's term is going to largely turn on the outcome of these cases. It's interesting in that both cases, the more restrained ruling would end up resulting in favoring Republican interests. So in the census case, the more restrained ruling would be to say it's not our job to second guess the political branches. We've had citizenship questions on the census before. We're not going to get into underlying motives. We're going to leave that to the political process. And if people don't like what is happening in the political process, well, there's always an election just around the corner. That's the same argument in the political gerrymandering context, the partisan gerrymandering context. Courts are divided as to whether or not there are really standards that a court can use to say you've gone too far, because everybody understands that partisan politics are going to play a role in redistricting. The question in this case, or the principal question in these two cases, these gerrymandering cases, is whether or not the partisan gerrymandering should be treated as a political question that courts will not get involved in. What's going to be hard for the court is that if, in fact, by a 5-4 decision, that is the outcome, and the court says we're not going to oversee gerrymandering anymore. The problem is that lower courts around the country have come up with standards and applied them and found there to be partisan gerrymandering around the country. So again, as Jen said, the optics are such that it looks as though, or some will say, fair or not, it looks as though the Supreme Court is acting as an agent of the Republican Party. Whether that's fair or not, that's a much longer conversation. But those will be the optics.
Well, and I'm glad you raised the issue of narrow versus broad ruling, because that often comes up when we talk about these. And sometimes people are waiting for a big statement from the court, and then the court will only say, this ruling applies to this case, and that's it. So don't infer anything more broadly from this. So, Jen, can you talk about that as well? What might it mean if the court issues a narrow ruling where it only weighs in on Maryland and North Carolina?
Well, if it only weighs in on Maryland and North Carolina, of course, that's going to constrain the ruling. But then again, it's the law of the land. I think what's more important than focusing on the state is whether the court does two things. First, whether it decides that even getting involved is what we call a justiciable issue, so whether or not the court can even get involved. And then secondly, if the court can get involved, whether or not they have enough information to conquer what they've tried to conquer before, which is there a standard by which they can actually determine whether partisan gerrymandering is inappropriate or appropriate?
All right. Well, coming up, a lot more cases to look at, including what the court said about a consumer antitrust suit aimed at tech giant Apple. We'll also look at a case concerning a war memorial and whether that violated separation of church and state. And we'll start taking your calls. So join us at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org.
You listen to NHPR to follow the events that affect many of us here in New Hampshire and beyond our borders, from the debates over immigration to rising sea levels to health care. Hey, I'm Lauren Chulgen, politics and policy reporter for NHPR. I'm asking you to contribute now to support your source for high-quality journalism. Your gift today will ensure that NHPR remains your reliable news source in the year to come. Contribute now at nhpr.org, and thanks.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court wraps up for the summer, and so we're looking at significant decisions from this term. Let's hear from you. What do you think was one of the most important cases before the court? What questions or comments do you have about it? Send them by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, it's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Jennifer Sargent, visiting associate professor at Dartmouth College, also a former public defender and district judge, and John Graby, director of UNH Law's Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service, and a law professor. And both of you, let's turn to one that I found particularly interesting. It has to do with a World War I memorial. And Jen, can you just give us the basics of this? There was this memorial on a public square in Maryland, and people got upset about it. What was going on there?
Right. This is the American Legion versus American Humanist Association case. And what's going on here is there's this big cross at kind of an intersection place in this town in Maryland. And it's a 40-foot cross honoring soldiers from World War I, and it's on government land. So the question is whether or not this enormous 40-foot cross that's maintained by the state, maintained by the town or the city, violates the separation of church and state under the First Amendment. And the majority of the court, it was a 7-2 decision. The two dissenters were Ruth Bader Ginsburg, joined by Sonia Sotomayor. And the majority said, yeah, it's a cross, but over time, it has developed a secular purpose. This landmark has been here, I believe it was since 1925. It was put up to honor the soldiers who died from the town in World War I. There have been gatherings around it since that have been secular, such as Memorial Day gatherings and Veterans Day gatherings. And it's really lost its, even if it was put up initially for a religious purpose, it's lost that religious purpose and has a secular purpose of celebration and memorial. And that time has really been a critical factor here. The court did not say in the majority opinion that if it was erected today, that it wouldn't violate.
Oh, that's interesting.
But that it because of the time that has passed. Yeah, and in fact, Justice Kavanaugh, who wrote the decision, seems to sort of intimate that he thinks that even if it was today, if it was built today, it would still be okay. But the court certainly doesn't say that in its decision.
This was one of those instances, Jen, where the court said, this cross is okay, it's World War I, but don't cities and towns across America think that you can go ahead and do this and pass muster right now.
Yeah, a court always just tries to decide a case as narrowly as possible. And here it was the history that really was the situation. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg vehemently disagreed with this interpretation. In fact, she went so far as to say a cross is linked with Jesus. There's no way to get the religion out of a cross. Just the way a Star of David is linked to the Jewish religion, Judaism, and the cross doesn't represent everybody, and it's exclusive. And because it's exclusive, it's religious, and it shouldn't be there.
On public property.
Correct.
Somebody could put it on private property.
Absolutely.
Without any problem. And John just asked me to put on your constitutional law professor hat. So what does the First Amendment say about religious expression or freedom of religion in this country?
Well, the First Amendment contains two religion clauses. The first is the one that was at issue here, the Establishment Clause, that says that you know, Congress shall make no law concerning an establishment of religion, but it also has a free exercise clause. And how to balance interests between those two has been a very, very vexing constitutional problem. Many people say that this area of the law is among the most complicated because at the time that the First Amendment was adopted, there was just no clear understanding about establishment. One of the striking things about this case is that, once again, the Supreme Court declined to apply the precedent that on its face seemingly should direct the analysis. There's a 1971 decision, Lemon versus Kurtzman, that set forth a test, the Lemon test, for determining whether or not the Establishment Clause is violated by religious symbols in the public sphere. But for a while now, the court has not been applying that test. That test gives a lot of power to judges. As Jen said, this decision really emphasized that it's a different consideration entirely when we have something that has been in the public sphere for a long time, and the question is whether to take it down, because the act of taking it down could well be seen as an act of hostility towards religion.
Oh, that's interesting. I see. And it has been there for 100 years.
Almost 100 years now, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, Jen.
I just want to correct myself. I did say that Kavanaugh was the one who authored the decision. It was actually an opinion authored by Justice Alito, but Kavanaugh concurred.
Interesting. Okay, so that one has already been settled. We're still waiting to hear on the cases we talked about earlier, the gerrymandering case and the citizenship question.
Can I give
case.
One last, yeah. just one la- sure. last little interesting aspect of that case? And it was something Justice Thomas dissented. And more generally, this has been a really interesting term, because Justice Thomas has been expressing an eagerness to revisit a whole bunch of foundational Supreme Court constitutional law precedents in some of his separate opinions throughout the term. And this is one of those where he suggested that the Establishment Clause does not confer an individual right on citizens to complain about an intermingling of religion and the public. He says the Establishment Clause should be read simply to protect the states from the federal government establishing a church and telling the states, you have to accept this as the established church in the United States. That would be a radical transformation of First Amendment law if he were able to get, several other justices to join with him in that view.
So he's concerned not so much if the states establish, air quotes here, a religion, but more that the feds can't tell the states this is the religion you should establish.
Right. And he doesn't think that this clause actually applies to the states at all. He doesn't think that there would be a federal constitutional problem were the states to establish a religion. There might be a problem under state constitutional law, but that the First Amendment should not be read to limit the states with respect to establishments of religion.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, go ahead, Jen, and then let's move on to another case.
And just sort of to point out something broader, this term has really shown some interesting trends in the conservative bloc. For the first time in a long time, we're seeing the conservatives doing what we've sort of predicted they're doing, but two of them, for instance, Justice Thomas, has this really aggressive originalism going on, whereas Justice Alito is showing real constitutional restraint. He's showing some significant restraint in the way he's approaching some cases. And I think that it's just very interesting to watch how the justices in the conservative bloc are, whether they're playing their hand close to their vest or whether they're showing all their cards.
What does originalism mean?
Well, originalism is, what does the Constitution actually say?
Like word by word.
Word by word, very closely linked to textualism. And Justice Thomas has always maintained that he is an originalist.
Well, let's turn to another case that is well known among our listeners, Flowers versus Mississippi. It's received a lot of attention and so much controversy that it was the subject of a series-long podcast from NPR called In the Dark. A lot of people probably listen to that. And John, if you could please just remind us the basics of this case. A man named Flowers accused of murder, and then this multiple trials just seemed to go on forever. So what happened there?
Yeah, he actually went through six trials, and he was convicted and sentenced to death at the sixth trial. And so this is an appeal that went to the Supreme Court challenging that conviction. But, you know, the background is really rather stunning in that, first of all, to actually have to go through trials so many times because, you know, there were either hung juries or there were errors in earlier cases. But the issue that the Supreme Court took up was whether or not there had been unconstitutional discrimination in the use of peremptory challenges by the prosecutor in the sixth case, but throughout the process of trying this man. And in a, you know, and this is striking, in a 7-2 decision, the Supreme Court said yes, that the evidence here of bias in the use of peremptory challenges was such that the court could not turn its eyes away, basically.
And what are those, John, peremptory challenges?
Peremptory challenges. So before a trial, each side, and they exist in both criminal cases and in civil cases, but during the process of selecting the jury, each side gets a number of challenges where they can dismiss potential jurors without giving an explanation.
Oh, that's interesting. They're
peremptory
in
that way.
I don't want this person on the jury. I don't have to tell you why.
That's right. And they're to be contrasted with challenges for cause. So if a juror says, oh, yeah, I knew the murder victim, that juror, that potential juror would not be permitted to sit. That person would be challenged for cause. Peremptory means you can just say, I don't want juror number 17, potential juror number 17, to sit on this case.
So again and again, over and over, as these cases came up, the prosecutor kept saying, I don't want this person on, peremptory challenge. And the person in question each time happened to be African-American.
That's right. And moreover, with respect to potential jurors, the evidence was that the prosecutor asked many, 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 many more questions of potential of African-American potential jurors than white potential jurors. And that was also indicative of bias because, you know, the more questions you ask, the more you can unearth some sort of basis for saying, I don't want this person to sit on the jury. You know, the problem, of course, though, is if you're only asking questions of people of one racial group and not the other.
Wow. So that's what happened legally, and this has been going on for a long time, more than 20 years. This case has been going back and forth. Mr. Flowers is still on death row, from what I understand. So what does this mean for this particular case, Jen, this 7-2 decision that basically says, yeah, the prosecution in this Mississippi case looks a little fishy?
Well, it certainly means that Batson is still alive and well, the Batson decision that started the whole idea of racial discrimination on the jury, and you can't just strike jurors for race or religion or anything like that, but there are certain qualities that you've got to uphold in giving somebody a fair trial. But more importantly, it's super narrow. In fact, even though I talked about Justice Alito just now, he is in the majority. So he said, yes, in this case, there's no way that this could pass constitutional muster. But he wrote a concurrence in this case that said, this case is so narrow that, yeah, there's a line in the sand here, but I got to say, it's so unique that this may be, you know, a one-off.
So this is one of those very narrow decisions where you can't infer broadly what this means for courts across America.
No, but Batson is still well and alive. I think that's what you can infer from it.
Yeah. Do you want to jump in, John?
Yeah, no, just, I mean, there are people, in fact, the dissent in this case said that we should do away with this case, Batson versus Kentucky, which was decided in the 1980s, which is the case that holds that the Constitution does not permit you to use your peremptory challenges in a criminal case or in a civil case for purposes of excluding jurors of a particular race. There are many people who would suggest that you know, that it's hard to police that when you, on the one hand, are giving each side the right to say, I just have a bad feeling about that juror. That's what peremptory challenges do. But on the other hand, are saying, but you can't exercise that discretion in a way that takes into account the race. And subsequent case law has extended the principle also to gender. So there have been some questions about whether or not this line of authority should remain vibrant, and at least for now it is, and the Batson case remains law that the Supreme Court is going to enforce.
All right. Turning to a couple other cases, and again, I want to remind you that you can join us with your questions or comments about some of the big cases before the U.S. Supreme Court this term. The court is wrapping up its term. today, and there are a couple major decisions that are still to come, including on the citizenship question and also on gerrymandering. We've looked at that, and we're looking at a couple other big cases that have already been decided. We'll take your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. By the way, if listeners want to know about that case that we just talked about concerning juries and racial discrimination, the podcast is from American Public Media, not NPR, so I misspoke. It's from APM, and it's called In the Dark. Let's talk about an antitrust case that I found very interesting. This has to do with a consumer lawsuit against tech giant Apple. This one brought by a group of iPhone users who allege that Apple is violating federal laws by requiring them to buy apps exclusively from Apple's App Store, if that's enough app for you in that sentence. And Jen, I found this really interesting because when I first read it as a non-legal person, I thought, well, isn't that just how it goes? I mean, you have an Apple phone, you buy your apps at the App Store. Like, what's the problem here? The court isn't deciding that, though. The court is deciding whether or not these consumers have sort of standing to go ahead and sue. So just kind of pull that back for us, if you could,
exactly.
Please.
Exactly. So if you think of Apple as a bunch of shelves, right, and individual developers of apps, they put their apps on Apple shelves. And Apple gets to keep a 30% commission for what the developers charge. So the developers set their own price for these apps, and then Apple just warehouses them and says, every time an app comes off our shelf, we'll keep 30% and y'all get the rest, developers.
That's a nice hefty markup.
Nice hefty markup. So these four individuals said, well, wait a minute. You know, if the only place really that they can warehouse these is at Apple, and that even though they get to set their price, they're so dominant in the market that no other developer is going to want to put their product on any other shelves. This kind of may raise the price because of the 30% markup that Apple is going to take.
So it feels monopolistic.
Exactly.
So they have complete control over pricing.
Right. And so the question was, well, Apple defended itself and said, look, they're not buying directly from us. And therefore, we shouldn't be the ones who citizens should be able to go after. And the Supreme Court said, in a majority opinion, no, actually, you're pretty much the direct link to these.
Well, it's like if I buy Tide soap at the grocery store, I'm not really buying the soap from Tide. I'm buying it from, you know, Market Basket or Hannaford or wherever I might be. So,
right. But the apps are developed by the developers, and the developers set the price and they put them on the shelves. So they have a lot of ownership over those apps. And that's what Apple was saying. We don't really control anything. We just give them the platform.
So the Supreme Court did not decide, correct me if I'm wrong, John, they did not decide, you know, the consumers are right or Apple is right or the developers are right. They just said, this lawsuit seems legit. It can go forward.
That's right. I mean, this is a civil lawsuit. And the question was whether or not the complaint is such that there's a plausible theory for relief in the complaint. And the Supreme Court, 5-4, said, yeah, you know, we think that this is plausible. You know, one of the couple interesting things about this case, the first is that the lineup that Justice Kavanaugh, who wrote the case, lined up with the four more liberal justices on this case. Another thing that we look at a lot in law classes is whether the court engages in sort of formalistic reasoning or realistic reasoning. Here we had an interesting breakdown in that Kavanaugh went with the liberals and went with a more formalistic approach and said, no, you know, they distinguished older antitrust precedent and said, as you said, at the end of the day, you are doing business with Apple. And therefore, and that's a requirement for bringing an antitrust claim of this sort. You have the dissenting justices say, no, realistically here, it's the, you know, your complaint is about the business that you're doing with these third parties. So that's always kind of interesting to track, too. Like, what at the end of the day leads the court to characterize the issue in either, you know, a more formalistic way, as they did here, or to say, let's dig a little deeper and say what's really going on.
Yeah, it was interesting. Kavanaugh, as you said, did side with the liberal wing of the court, saying that, you know, monopolistic retailers, his words, not mine, don't deserve a get out of court free card. I thought that was really interesting. So, all right, a couple more cases to tackle coming up, including this question: can the state and federal governments try someone for the same crime? We'll find out. Stay with us.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Join us to catch up on all the state news stories you might have missed. That's tomorrow on The Exchange with host Peter Biello. This hour, as the U.S. Supreme Court gets ready to wrap up for the summer, we're finding out about some of the most important decisions of this term. And let's hear from you. Your questions or comments about key rulings from the High Court are, of course, welcome. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org or call 1-800-892-6477. Jennifer Sargent is here, visiting associate professor at Dartmouth College, also a former public defender and district judge, along with John Graby, director of UNH Law's Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service, and a law professor. And both of you, I wanted to ask you about something that I thought was really interesting. I'd love for you to explain it to me, concerning a ruling that came down just last week concerning what's called double jeopardy. So, Jen, just remind us what that is.
Sure. The Fifth Amendment provides to the Constitution provides that basically no person should be tried twice for the same offense or put in jeopardy for the same offense. But there's this dual sovereignty rule that exists, which says states and the federal government are two different sovereigns, and each of them has the opportunity to bring charges against the individual for basically duplicative offenses. So what happened here in the case is Gamble versus United States is a gentleman from Alabama, Terrence Gamble, in 2015 was driving with his taillight out and he was pulled over and the police discovered that he was unlawfully possessing a firearm. So Terrence Gamble was charged with possessing a firearm both in the state and for the federal courts. And the question became, Can this person be tried twice for the same offense? But more interesting.
So he had a firearm, excuse me for interrupting, illegally under federal law and state law.
Yes.
Okay. So go ahead.
So the question becomes, is it fair for Terrence Gamble to be tried twice? Because once somebody is tried and punished, is it really just the kind of thing where you want to increase it again? I just want to make sure I'm not confusing this case with Gundy.
Well, there have been a lot of cases. And I guess while you're checking that, okay, I will ask you, John, it is interesting that, you know, federal law often says one thing and then it has discretion for the states to say something a little bit different. Federal gun laws say one thing. Sometimes state laws are stricter. So how do you avoid people being tried twice, once at the state level and once at the federal level?
Well, usually a decision is made to, you know, to let one authority or the other go ahead.
I mean, it's
not common for people, you know, to be charged and tried by, you know, on the one hand, the federal courts and then also the state courts. You know, the U.S. attorney and the attorney general of the state are often in conversation with each other. Federal law tends to be to impose more serious penalties. Also, federal prisoners tend to serve a longer percentage of their terms than do state prisoners because there's no parole in the federal system. And so oftentimes a judgment's made based on, you know, how dangerous this person is. You know, is this a repeat offender? You know, if so, you know, they'll go federal with it, you know. Other times they'll sometimes go state with it. But there are some very high profile examples where different jurisdictions have brought charges. Those of us older enough to remember Rodney King. Remember when Rodney King was beaten? And then there were, of course, riots when the police officers involved in that were actually acquitted in the state courts. Subsequently, though, federal authorities brought charges and they were convicted in that case. And that was an example of a situation where double jeopardy did not apply because the federal government is, as Jen said, you know, a different and separate sovereign from the state government.
Oh, that's really interesting. So usually, John, the law enforcement authorities at the state and federal level kind of work it out.
That's right. Yeah,
who's going to take this
right,
one?
You know, it's not. It's just a matter of simple efficiency.
Yeah. Gotcha. Go ahead, Jen.
All right. So I was right. This week, by the way, the last 2 weeks, it's been like the Coachella of the Supreme Court. It's just been kind of incredible without the costumes. So in any event, in the double jeopardy case, Gamble versus United States, Justice Ginsburg and Justice Gorsuch were the dissenters. And really interesting, right? Gorsuch and Ginsburg in the same place.
Yeah, one's very conservative and one's considered very
and
liberal.
And their dissents couldn't be more different. Justice Gorsuch did a really interesting recitation of English history, basically, and went all the way back to England and said, you know, there are lots of historical reasons for not allowing separate sovereigns to have this ability. Most notably, you know, we don't want show trials like King George used to have, and then say, okay, because that was a show trial, the person doesn't get a real trial somewhere else, that the federal government's ability to prosecute is, or the state's government, like they provide a check on each other. Justice Ginsburg kind of took the opposite approach and said, this is just patently unfair. Once somebody's been tried and had their day in court, nobody should be able to go after them again just because they want to get the revenge or have a result that wasn't gotten the first time.
Although, as John gave in those examples, it sounds like, Jen, this does happen occasionally.
Oh, it absolutely happens. But that's the law.
Yeah. So this case seemed to say, and it shouldn't happen too often.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Okay. All right. Well, I did want to ask both of you, before we look at what the U.S. Supreme Court might consider next session, and there's a lot that will come before the court next session, but some other cases decided this term that I didn't ask you about, John, maybe didn't get as much attention as the ones that we've talked about, but you think are worth knowing about.
Well, I always say in conversation with people who become cynical and throw up their hands and say, "Oh, they're all the same when it comes time to vote," my initial response is always, one of the consequences of an election is that a new administration, a new president, gets to appoint the leaders of the administrative state, and in actuality, that is who we are governed by these days, particularly at a time when it's difficult for Congress to come together in any way. It's really the administrative agencies that set the tone for regulation in the United States. For a while now, there has been a move to rein in the power at least among some, to rein in the power of administrative agencies, particularly in more, conservative and libertarian legal circles, because there are doctrines that courts have developed that really defer to administrative agencies, that give them a lot of discretion.
By administrative agencies, pardon me for interrupting, you mean Department of Health and Human Services, and so on?
Exactly. The EPA, the SEC, the FCC.
Sure.
In any event, there were a couple of cases this term where the court actually put on the docket the question of whether or not it should overrule longstanding precedents, or whether it should actually revive a doctrine that existed back in the 1930s that the court used to sort of closely examine and second guess administrative agencies. In neither case did the court go there. It did not revive the so-called non-delegation doctrine from the 1930s, nor, in an opinion that came out this week, did they decide to overrule a precedent that allows for deference to agencies. But in both cases, they suggested that they're going to really be cutting things back. I'd have to go in the weeds to explain any more, but basically, I think the message is loud and clear from the Supreme Court. Do not expect the same deference to actions of administrative agencies by courts as we have seen historically.
And is that, pardon my pronunciation, stare decisis? Because I was just reading about that this morning.
That's right. Well, stare decisis, yes, the Latin term that says the court is going, the court stands by its decisions. And I think, especially with respect to the case where it decided not to overturn this older precedent known as Auer, I think stare decisis played a role. But you can overturn a precedent without formally overturning it. And a lot of people suggest that that's pretty close to what the court did yesterday. They suggested, we're not going to overturn Auer, but we're going to take a really, really close look at what happens under Auer, and we're going to really rein in the discretion that judges have historically accorded administrative agencies under this doctrine known as the Auer Doctrine.
Wow, okay. So a lot of detail there, but I think I see what you're getting at, actually. So thank you for explaining it, because I was reading up on this morning, and now I think I get what you're saying.
Yeah, the bottom line is it's going to be harder, I think, for administrative agencies to be so freewheeling. And when people object to it, say, wait, no, what you're doing now is not consistent with what you've done in the past. It's not consistent with your own prior regulations. You know, courts have pretty much, you know, been hands off. They're suggesting they're going to be a little bit more hands on and saying, is what you're doing really consistent with this regulation that you have passed, you know, that you have enacted in the past?
Okay. And your turn, Jen, in terms of other cases that caught your attention that you thought were really important, but that we haven't talked about today.
Well, there's a really important case, in my opinion, called Carpenter versus Murphy. And that case has to do with whether or not much of eastern Oklahoma is, in fact, an Indian reservation. And the reason that that's important is because Indian reservations, they have their own jurisdiction. They are their own sovereign. To some extent, and although the federal government, the law is that, you know, they have some limited jurisdiction over some things and not over other things, and it can get quite confusing. But if a massive portion of Oklahoma is in fact an Indian reservation, then that's going to really impact what is going on in that section of Oklahoma, and also it's got some implications for the future because Native lands are more extensive than currently recognized, and this could open some, I wouldn't say floodgates, but definitely some litigation opportunities for those kinds of lawsuits to enlarge Native lands and reservations.
So that has not yet been decided?
That has not yet been decided.
Okay.
We're waiting for that today.
Yeah,
very
morning.
Interesting. So states with large Native populations might be looking at this saying, if the tribe prevails, or if the question is resolved in favor of Native Americans, would that open up the opportunity, you're saying, Jen, for other Native peoples to say, hey, this chunk of land that you gave us isn't big enough. We need more.
That's possible. But it also has to do with the recognition of Native American sovereignty and that the federal government is constraining Native American sovereignty and not recognizing reservations for what they are, which is large.
All right. One last question for both of you, and I can't believe we're talking about this already because there's still some cases to be decided in this term, but I really want to ask both of you what cases the court might consider next session, because there's been a lot of conversation about this. So go ahead, John. What issues do you think will come before the High
Court? Well, I mean, two areas that I have my eyes on. The first is abortion. You know, around the country, state legislatures are enacting very, very restrictive abortion laws. These laws are patently inconsistent with prevailing precedent from the Supreme Court on the extent to which states can regulate the abortion decision. And, you know, over the next year, those cases are going to work their way through the appellate process. And the other thing, of course, is, you know, we have so many showdowns taking place right now between the House of Representatives and the executive with respect to congressional oversight over the president in the wake of the Mueller report, you know, wanting to do investigations with respect to, you know, so many things going on. And the executive branch is really taking an unprecedentedly broad view of its power to be free from oversight by Congress. Eventually, those disputes will make their way into the court system if Congress issues subpoenas and if witnesses refuse to comply with those subpoenas and if Congress goes to court to try to get an order directing those witnesses to do so. And I don't think it's an overstatement to say that we could have, you know, some, you know, profoundly difficult constitutional moments, particularly if the administration does not abide by lower court rulings. And there are some who wonder whether or not it will.
What do you think, Jen? What else do you expect to be coming before the court next year? Those are two biggies that John mentioned.
Well, he's spot on with regard to that. Maybe we'll see some of the issues that we saw in Masterpiece Cake Shop and also the florist case, I think it's Klein, That was sent back down.
Those are religious exemptions. That's right. Religious exemption for same-sex marriage law,
and vendors and commercial operations not giving services like floral design or cake baking, wedding cake baking to same-sex couples for their marriages. The second case following Masterpiece Cake Shop was sent back down this term by the Supreme Court to be decided by the lower courts in light of the decision in Masterpiece Cake. So that's going to climb back up eventually, I have a feeling. I don't know if it's going to be up so fast, so we might not see it next term. But it's really important to keep our eyes on that one.
Can you just explain to me, please, Jen, how these state abortion laws make their way through the courts and up to the highest court? You know, a lot of people look at these laws and they say, okay, this should go before the court. And everybody is saying, eventually, these will end up before the court. But what's the eventual about?
Well, the eventual is about getting all of those cases through the lower courts. So first...
And they have to do that.
They have to do that. There is no original jurisdiction. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that these cases have any reason to bypass the ordinary course of litigation.
Unlike the census question, which we talked about earlier.
Correct.
That one vaulted straight up to the high court.
Well, that one, the Supreme Court allowed, but it still went to the district court. It wasn't like there was any original jurisdiction or anything like that. But the cases have to wend their way up through the process. And we know in the abortion cases that there's the loser is always going to appeal. So it's going to go up there.
Okay. And in terms of your constitutional law side of the business, John, that you do at UNH Law, you'll be busy with executive privilege, legislative power. There'll be a lot for you to focus on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and really, you know, just the charged politics around the court and judicial appointments right now. I mean, you know, this will be the first term where Justice Brett Kavanaugh will have been on the court, bringing the court back to nine. This is it, of course, in the aftermath of the Merrick Garland nomination not going through and Neil Gorsuch being confirmed to replace him. You know, it'll be interesting to meet, too, because next year is a presidential election and the extent to which the court is part of the conversation. It was striking to me last night that it didn't come up, at least in the part of the Democratic debate that I saw. They didn't talk about the court, whereas, you know, in the Republican debates, the court is always front and center as an issue. And I wonder if that'll hold. I do wonder whether... I think there are a lot of people on the Democratic side of things who are extremely frustrated by what's happened at the Supreme Court. And moreover, what we're seeing actually in the Senate with respect to lower court judges is that the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, is fast-tracking appointments. And President Trump is way, way, way ahead of where President Obama was at this point in his term in terms of confirming appeals court judges and district court judges in the federal courts.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens later this morning on those two big cases we talked about earlier. For now, thank you both very much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.